I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Wendy Johnson. She's medical director at the La Familia Medical Center here in Santa Fe. And we're here today to talk about vaccines. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be on again.
It's always great to have you and get a sense of what's going on in public health.
Yeah. Yeah.
And vaccinations have been in, and to some extent are still in the news. And it's such an interesting, I don't even know if you want to call it debate, but conversation that's going on. But I thought maybe we could start with reminding people what a vaccine is and how it came to be that we could vaccinate ourselves against illnesses.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the things that has created this anti-vaccine movement that we're seeing is there's very few people alive today that really saw the devastation that a lot of these infectious diseases caused in the early part of the 1900s before we had vaccines. We had measles, we had smallpox at that time, which has been totally eradicated from the earth. We had whooping cough and diphtheria and many, many diseases.
Polio.
Polio, exactly. The like rooms full of iron lungs. Many, many diseases that devastated, you know, thousands and thousands, if not millions, all over the world and caused millions of deaths all over the world. That vaccines have really revolutionized our child mortality rates, our infant mortality rates, and people didn't live through that period where when you had a kid, you didn't really know if the kid would live to be 5 years old because these diseases were killing, in a lot of countries they still do kill, up to 1 in 10 kids or more, 1 in 5 kids. In many countries, you know, half the kids even would not make it to their 5th birthday because of these diseases.
And so mothers were finding themselves in the position of having 5 to 10 kids.
Right.
Just to have a couple survive into adulthood.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that is a big deal when we see child mortality rates drop, we see fertility rates drop, we see, you know, women being able to get educated, and there's all kinds of ripple effects from this. But we didn't live through this. And so I think we have a false sense of security, especially in the United States, that these diseases aren't very devastating, that why are we worried about, you know, a little measles, a little rash, and because people didn't live through the time when nobody was vaccinated. I think that vaccines have been revolutionary. And for the most part, the cost-benefit relationship, the risk of vaccines, is very, very, very small. And a lot of the fear that has been stoked about vaccines come from a lot of misinformation, badly done studies. And I think two things I would say in this day and age. One, the main message that I want everyone to know is it's very important to get vaccinated. The Santa Fe Public Schools has just implemented a mandatory requirement, especially for measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. And at La Familia Medical Center, we have two locations, one at Alto Street and one at Southside near the corner of Lopez and Agua Fria. People can come in and make a well-child check appointment and get vaccines. And one thing I want to really emphasize is that vaccines are really important, but it's also really important for people with children to get that appointment with their physician at least every year and more often when their kids are under 2, because vaccines are a very critical part of that visit. But it's actually not just enough just to get the vaccines, because there's a lot of screening for illness that happens in the visit that is really important for your child's health long term. And so please don't skimp on that. Don't think you just have to get the vaccines and you're covered. That well-child check appointment is very, very important.
What kinds of illnesses might you find with a well-child check for a kid under 2?
A lot of the times for kids under 2, there's a lot of subtle developmental issues that need to be screened for. If we can catch them early, we can really mitigate the effects of them when the kids go into school. Things like hearing or vision problems for young kids, or other kinds of learning problems or developmental problems with motor control, that sometimes if we can catch those very early, we can really do a lot with them. There's also a lot of nutritional stuff. We're learning more and more about how nutrition in those first couple of years of life really affects how healthy you're going to be for your whole life, whether or not you're going to get diabetes or high blood pressure later in life, if you're really able to establish in those first few years of life good nutritional habits. And so working with parents on all of those things are super important in those first 2 years.
So let's talk for a moment about what a vaccination is and how it was invented.
The first person who invented the smallpox vaccine noticed that milkmaids who got cowpox didn't get smallpox or got a very light version of the illness and almost never died from it. And so from that, it was figured out that if you were to take some of the basically substance in the virus, or a virus that looked very similar to the virus, or a piece of the virus, that your body would mount an immune response to it, create antibodies to it, so that if you ever encountered the real live virus, that you could fight it off much more effectively and possibly not even have any effects of the illness itself because you would be immunized against it. Your body, you'd kind of trick your body to thinking it had already seen this virus, and so it already knew how to fight it off. Even though you were using either, in the case of polio, the first virus that was developed was actually a live virus, but that didn't cause illness. And so it didn't cause the effects, the devastating effects of polio. Now we have an inactivated poliovirus, which is dead. But some viruses are lookalikes to the ones that are pathogenic, that cause disease. But most of our vaccines now are parts of the virus or lookalike parts of the virus that provoke an immune response in you, even though they're not able to cause disease.
So basically, your body is building up a kind of defense force against an enemy that isn't strong enough to vanquish it, so that when that same or similar enemy that is strong enough comes in later, the defenses are already there.
That's exactly right. It's like teaching your body to build a wall against this particular virus, so the wall is up when the actual virus comes.
And so that whole thing with the milkmaids was in the 18th century, and we've been in several centuries of development.
Right.
And it was really in the 20th century that this all took off, to where we've got this whole array of childhood vaccines that allow you and me and most of our listeners to live the healthy lives we've got.
That's right. And now they're working on vaccines. We're fairly, I would say fairly close, hopefully, to getting an HIV vaccine, to getting a malaria vaccine even, which is a parasite. So
that's,
that would be very
huge.
Interesting. Exactly. And those are illnesses that devastate whole countries that, you know, I worked in Africa for a couple of years. I saw the effects of those illnesses on families. You know, malaria especially kills millions of kids around the world every year. So,
and has done so for forever.
Yeah, forever. Yeah, for a very long time. And so the fact that we've figured out this technology and how to do this, we can apply it to a lot of different diseases. And we have. And now in this country, we have basically eliminated many diseases that used to cause a lot of illness and death in the population. You know, there were about 500,000 cases of measles every year before the measles vaccine came. And so that's incredibly important.
So why does anybody not want to vaccinate their children?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And what I think is sad is that the you called it a debate or conversation. And wouldn't it be great if we could have a conversation rather than a debate? And I think once you call it a debate, and once you marginalize those people that have questions about vaccines or are questioning why we do certain vaccines in a certain way, I think that you shut it down. And I think in public health, it's almost never the right approach to shut down debate. I think it's never the right approach to not engage. I certainly think there's a small minority of what's called the anti-vaxxer movement that is very difficult to talk to, and it's never going to come around. But the majority of people who I see in my practice who question vaccines, and frankly some very good friends who question vaccines and why we have them, they're not in that anti-vaxxer camp. And they have very, very reasonable concerns. And I think that to the extent that we as doctors can be honest about those concerns and address them at the level where people are, I think that we do much better in making the case for the important vaccines.
We're talking to Dr. Wendy Johnson from La Familia Medical Center. So what are, in your view, the legitimate concerns that your patients are coming in with?
Well, I'll tell you a story about a good friend of mine from college who had a child that was about a year and a half old and was getting the varicella vaccine, the vaccine against chickenpox. And shortly thereafter, within a day or two, developed a very debilitating seizure disorder, epilepsy, which now this child is in his teens and is got a very debilitating epilepsy, has had days when he's had hundreds of seizures, and is at the developmental level of a toddler. Now, you know, I personally am pretty certain that that wasn't caused by the vaccine.
Yeah, but I mean, there was another article recently that I read about a doctor who's had a patient in for a vaccine appointment. The kid had a seizure a minute before the vaccine was administered, and the doctor said, "My goodness, if the seizure had happened 5 minutes later, the parents would have said that was because of the vaccine."
Right. And you can understand that, because put yourself in the position of those moms for a second. And we give a lot of vaccines at that age, about 1 year old, when, first of all, the vaccines themselves can cause fevers. Secondly, that's the age when kids have a condition called are very susceptible to something called febrile seizures, where fevers can actually cause them to have a seizure. And if you're that mom, and this wasn't a febrile seizure, this was a very serious case of epilepsy, which is long lasting and lifelong and caused very serious effects in this kid. But if you're that mom, of course you're going to freak out. Of course, then she has two other younger kids, and she brought them in to get their vaccines. And one of the kids had also a very, very serious reaction to the what's called the DTaP, the tetanus, pertussis, and whooping cough vaccine. And after that, he basically had a febrile seizure after that. And after that, she didn't want to vaccinate her very youngest kid. If I were her doctor, I would support that in that case. Not necessarily because I think the vaccines cause the problem in this case, but I can totally empathize with that mom's concerns about the vaccines and the devastation that she saw in her oldest child and the fear. And I think those cases are very rare, incredibly rare, like one in a million. But I think we need to meet people where they are, because I think when we just shut down any concerns that anybody has about these vaccines, I think then we look like we have something to hide as the medical profession. And if we look at it very rationally, when parents come in and say, "Can I have an alternate schedule? Or does my little baby need a hepatitis B vaccine on its first day of life?" We can look at other countries and see that European countries, by and large, don't require hepatitis B vaccine except for high-risk groups. The varicella vaccine is usually not mandatory in most European countries. The rotavirus vaccine, there's several vaccines that other countries have determined that risk-benefit relationship doesn't warrant making them mandatory. So why can't we have in the United States a discussion with parents to say, if you're concerned about some of these vaccines, let's talk about them. Let's talk about the risk-benefit relationship. Let's try to understand which ones I think your kid really does need right now, and which ones that we could maybe put off for a year or two or a month or two or spread out in a different way, so that you as a mom feel comfortable and you don't feel coerced or forced into something against your will. Because I think that's never a good public health strategy.
When you vaccinate a young person, a baby, a child, and they mount an immune response, does it make sense to do a bunch of vaccines at one time, or does it make more sense to spread them out so that the body can mount its defense and then recover without being overwhelmed?
Well, the vaccine schedule that the United States has, recommended by the CDC, is shown to be effective. Also, there's some differences between the United States schedule and European schedule in the number of doses and the spacing of doses. But for the most important vaccines, which I would say are the DTaP or the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine, the MMR, the Haemophilus influenza vaccine, the pneumococcal vaccine, I'm afraid I'm going to forget one now, but those are some of the most important vaccines, I think, against diseases that the polio vaccine, against the diseases that we still have polio we don't necessarily have in the United States, but we still have in the world that still could make a comeback if people suddenly stopped getting them, and that are very devastating diseases. I think the schedule for those is pretty established, and the risk of those vaccines is very, very small, and the benefit is huge. So those have been well studied over a large number of years, and I think the schedule is reasonable. But my point really is, for other things, like, for example, varicella or hepatitis B, if a parent says, really, does my newborn need to get the hepatitis B? Well, actually, your newborn, if you as a pregnant mom don't have hepatitis B, then your newborn doesn't need to get the hepatitis B vaccine. And we can put that off, you know, if we want to put that off. That's a one that I think we can reasonably have a discussion to put off. So I think we can meet most of the patients that I've talked to who are quote unquote anti-vaccines. You can meet them halfway. You can talk to them reasonably about the risks and benefits, and people understand that.
There is a kind of culture of mistrust that has arisen between patients and doctors, or I think as many patients see it, patients and the system, and to some extent with good reason, and to some extent those feelings and emotions cloud reason. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point, and I think that what this anti-vax movement, I think, has in common with the Tea Party movement, actually, is that it signifies an erosion of trust. You know, in some countries like Finland, the vaccination rates are like almost 100%. And why is that different than the United States? Some of the vaccines are mandatory, as I said, some of them are not. So there are mandatory laws, but we have mandatory laws here too, and states that have very few exceptions. So what's the difference? I think that one thing that nobody's really talking about that leads to this erosion of trust is the fact that more and more you hear how influenced the medical system is by the money in the pharmaceutical industry. Another unrelated issue, but recently there was a recommendation made that hugely expanded the use of what's called statins, which is a medicine for high cholesterol, and recommended that up the many, many people who are really healthy be put on statins because they might potentially have a risk of cardiovascular disease. And this was really based on almost no evidence. And the panel that made these recommendations, the majority of this panel and the majority and the organizations that made these recommendations are hugely supported by the drug companies that make these drugs. And this was reported in the New York Times, it was reported in the media. There were a lot of other doctors that said, well, these recommendations aren't very good because there's no evidence and they're really clouded by this. But we get information every day almost about the influence of money, you know, in politics, influence of money in our medical system, the pharmaceutical companies really buying off doctors more or less. And I think that really contributes to the erosion of trust.
And the insurance system,
yeah,
on top of that, the whole thing is on some kind of market model that,
right,
doesn't necessarily make sense for medicine.
Right. And I think that, you know, with vaccines, and I can say this, vaccines don't make up a huge part of, pharmaceutical companies aren't making a ton of money off vaccines. But every so often, you know, there comes along a vaccine like the HPV vaccine, which is the vaccine against the virus that causes cervical cancer, that's now recommended for both boys and girls at 12 years old. And Merck, who makes that vaccine, lobbied like crazy the state legislatures and included giving tons of money in campaign contributions to governors and state legislators to add that to part of the mandatory vaccines. Now, if that's the way you're going to go about it, rather than evidence and going through the CDC, you have to be prepared for the backlash when people find out about that. Of course I'm going to be skeptical. Why are you lobbying the governor rather than just showing me the medical evidence that this is something that we should be doing? It's going to create suspicion.
And it's also going to create a kind of generalizing of that vaccine to all vaccines.
Exactly. And all drugs and all advice that doctors give. You know,
right,
can I really trust that you're just giving me this advice? Or did you get money from the, did you just have a nice dinner at the compound last night? And that's why you're pushing this.
Very interesting. So how is all of this playing out here in New Mexico?
It is interesting. I, at La Familia, you know, I see a patient population which is a cross-section of Santa Fe, but I would say another myth I would like to dispel is I see a lot of the immigrant population here, and there is a myth that, and I would say they are the population that's most unquestioning of the vaccines. You know, they really keep up with the vaccine schedules. They keep up with the well-child checks. And so there's this kind of myth about the immigrants, you know, bringing in disease and all that. That's completely untrue in my experience. I think, you know, we do have we're really big on alternative medicine here. We're really big on other kinds of modalities people are really into. I'm going to help my child have good nutrition and be healthy, and that's good enough. And I think there's a lot of that feeling here. But we've had cases of measles right here in, you know, in Santa Fe County. So we are not immune. And if we do have a measles epidemic, we do have a lot of pertussis in New Mexico, which is one thing that we recommend vaccinating against as well. It's in the DTaP vaccine that I talked about before. And the diseases are out there, and our unvaccinated rates are high here in New Mexico, and we could potentially see a resurgence of measles, I think. And so, you know, I think, but I again think that the best way to handle that is really the doctor's offices that say you can't come in, I'm going to discharge you as a patient if you don't vaccinate your kids. You know, I really have not seen the person in my practice that I can't talk to reasonably about the important vaccines. And if you work with them on schedules and on their concerns and meet them on their concerns, and if you have a good relationship as a doctor with your patients, you know, maybe the people who are totally anti-vax don't come to see an allopathic doctor like me. That's totally possible. But I think it behooves us to at least try to engage folks in conversation.
To what extent do we have mandatory vaccinations in Santa Fe and in New Mexico?
Well, I talked about the Santa Fe Public Schools just said that they had that you had to have the vaccinations to start school. There is legislation in the state legislature, I think, to make vaccines mandatory in New Mexico Hospital 522 is the legislation. And so that's working its way through the legislature. I'm not sure where that is right now.
When some number of people decides not to vaccinate their kids, and then those kids go through school and go through life unvaccinated, did they pose a public health problem to other people?
Well, yeah. You know, the instances where we've seen really bad measles outbreak in the last, you know, sort of 20 years since we started, or more since we started vaccinating kids against measles, are communities, religious communities, Amish community, fundamentalist religious community in Philadelphia. The big outbreaks have been religious communities where nobody is vaccinated. So there's this thing called herd immunity, which basically means that once the vaccination rate drops below a certain level, so, and that's not an absolute level, if the vaccination rate is 95, 99%, if I'm the only kid in my school that's not vaccinated against a certain thing, even the chances of me coming into contact with that thing are very low because everybody else is vaccinated. What we've seen with the Disney World outbreak is that enough people are not vaccinated, so the chances of me having the disease and coming into contact with somebody else who's also not vaccinated becomes higher. And so it can spread. Herd immunity means even though a few people might not be vaccinated, their chance of coming into contact with the disease, or if they get the disease, their chance of coming into contact with somebody else who's not vaccinated is very, very low.
And so basically, the people who don't vaccinate their kids are basically counting on everybody else's vaccinations to keep their kids healthy.
Yeah, and there's actually legal arguments about what happens if you choose to not vaccinate your kids. You know, it's a very interesting legal argument, I think, because we have to really be careful, I think, in public health about what things we make mandatory and how we coerce people to do things, as we said. But there's an interesting legal argument which says, okay, I can legally not vaccinate my kids. Maybe I can't go to public school because I'm endangering other kids. And the other legal argument is, well, if I don't vaccinate my kids and I don't have a good medical reason for not vaccinating my kids, and my kids make other people sick, am I legally liable? Could I sue you because your kid made my kid sick? You know, maybe my kid's not vaccinated because he has a immunocompromised disease or he has a good medical reason. Your kid's not vaccinated because you just decided not to vaccinate your kid. Your kid makes my kid sick. Can I sue you? Or what about the cost to the state of all that extra illness? What about the cost to taxpayers? What about the cost of, you know, emergency room visits and all of those things in the medical system? Should I be liable for that? So that was I heard an interesting discussion on that in Democracy Now, in the discussion of the vaccine, you know, back and forth. They had a great discussion about it.
Very interesting. So we're talking to Wendy Johnson, medical director of La Familia Medical Clinic, Medical Center, and you have an event coming up.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm glad you reminded me, because my folks would have gotten mad, but had I not mentioned that. But we have on, I don't usually plug La Familia that much on your show, Mary Charlotte, but just a little tiny plug for La Familia. La Familia Medical Center, it's the biggest community clinic here that we have in Santa Fe. We take care of the bulk of people who are uninsured, and you can come to La Familia if you're insured, and I think our medical care is excellent. We have full service family practice. We have obstetricians, gynecologists. We have internal medicine. We have a lot of community health education that we do in diabetes and obesity. We have a behavioral health department that's integrated with primary care. And basically our model is full service family centered care for everyone. You can have the same doctor that takes care of you, that takes care of your child, that takes care of your grandmother, that takes care of your whole family, that delivers your baby. We do about a third of the deliveries that happen in Santa Fe are done by our docs. But because we do a lot of folks that don't have insurance and don't have other means to pay, and anyone can come into La Familia and get medical care regardless of your ability to pay, we're a big nonprofit. We get some grants to cover that, but it doesn't cover all of our costs. So we're having a fundraiser, and it's really going to be very fun. It's our second annual Divine Decadence. It's a chocolate dessert challenge. So there are a lot of chefs in town that are participating, from Anasazi and La Boca and Santa Cafe and a lot of the big fancy restaurants in town. And it's at the Drury Plaza Hotel on March 7th at 6 p.m. And you can get tickets online at lafamiliasf.org.
And that's coming right up this Saturday.
That's right. Saturday evening at 6 p.m. I hope to see you all there.
Yes. Chocolate, ladies and gentlemen, which turns out to be not nearly quite as bad for you as everybody thought.
Yeah, we'll make sure it's the dark chocolate with not very much sugar, maybe. I don't know. But
whatever.
They were excellent last year. So.
Decadence is something that if you do from time to time,
yes,
it just makes your life happier.
This is my mantra as a family physician: everything in moderation.
Including moderation. Wendy Johnson, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.